Why not? Strabo's visit took place during the Roman domination of Egypt. In the year 47 BC, the Roman emperor Gaius Julius Caesar, 100 to 44 BC, defeated the Egyptian army and installed his mistress Cleopatra as queen of Egypt. 17 years later, 5 years prior to Strabo's visit, Egypt was declared a Roman province. Obviously, the Egyptian priests had no intention of revealing their ancient secrets to the Roman conquerors. In Egypt or elsewhere, Julius Caesar and his army were known for their ruthless plundering. It is likely that the Egyptian priests did what their colleagues in Central and South America did after the Spanish conquerors arrived. They hid their cultural treasures. Even 423 years before Strabo, Herodotus was not permitted to enter the subterranean halls. It does not seem surprising, then, that Strabo did not even hear about the underground tombs. Although he was Greek, Strabo was subject of the dreaded Roman Emperor because Greece, at the time, was part of that empire. Moreover, and this cannot be overemphasized, almost 500 years separate the visits of Herodotus and Strabo. In comparison, construction on the Cathedral of Cologne, Germany, was begun in 1248. 200 years later, the south steeple only ascended to the belfry. The cathedral was not completed until 1880. 500 years ago, the architects and builders, in all likelihood, would have been able to tell us something about the catacombs under the cathedral. Today, the tourists never hear about them. The time frame between Herodotus and Strabo is 423 years. That is no jiffy. At the time of Herodotus's visit, the priests were able to inform him proudly that he was seeing but half of the labyrinth, and that the other half, just as impressive, was buried under the ground. When Strabo came to call, the priests either no longer knew anything about the underground chambers or kept quiet for political reasons. It is possible that Strabo heard rumors about the royal sepulchres below the maze, but did not believe them and therefore chose to exclude them from his writings. 100 years after Strabo, the Roman historian Gaius Plinius Secundus, AD 61 to 113, also described the Egyptian labyrinth. Once more, we discover details that none of the previous authors mentioned. Apparently, Plinius had sources that neither Herodotus nor Strabo had access to. Interestingly, Plinius refers to Herodotus in an attempt to correct and supplement the latter. "Let us enter also into the labyrinths, which we may truly say are the most monstrous works that ever were devised by hand of man. Neither are they incredible and fabulous as peradventure it may be supposed. For one of them remaineth to be seen at this day within the jurisdiction of Heracleopolis. The first that was ever made, to wit, 3,600 years ago, by a king named Pedasuchus, or as some think, Titos. And yet, Herodotus saith, it was the whole work of many kings, one after another, and that Pasamericus was the first to put his hand to it, and made an end thereof. The reason that moved these princes to make this labyrinth is not resolved by writers, but divers causes are by them alleged. Certes, there is no doubt, made that Daedalus took from hence the pattern and platform of his labyrinth, which he made in Crete, but surely he expressed not above the hundredth part thereof." Plinius points out that the labyrinth of Daedalus was the second one. A third one was found in Lemnos, a fourth one in Italy. All were arched with polished stones. The Egyptian labyrinth consisted mostly of large blocks of syenite. Even the sentries could not destroy it, although the people of Heracleopolis did their best to damage the building, which they despised. According to Plinius, the labyrinth held the temples of all the Egyptian deities. Goddesses of vengeance in 40 chapels and several pyramids, each 40 yards high, whose bases covered an area of 6 acres. Already tired from walking, Plinius entered those convoluted criss-crossing passageways. But there were also dining halls above, and 90 steps descended into the galleries below, which featured porphyry columns, religious idols, statues of the kings, and all kinds of horrible creatures. Some of the houses were situated in such a way that a terrible thunder echoed through them each time the door was opened. Plinius affirms that in most of the labyrinth one was surrounded by darkness. Outside the wall there were several other large buildings called wings. Moreover, some houses were located in underground vaults. Of all the ancient accounts, Herodotus's description contains the most detail. This seems logical since Herodotus was the first one of all the authors discussed here to visit the maze. His eyewitness report and his account of what the priests told him about the underground structures date back the farthest in history. In other words, they are closest to the distant reality. Even if the various writers ascribe different names to the buildings of the labyrinth, they agree on the main points. The maze-like temple structure is located on the shores of Lake Myeres. There are artificial canals, and the city of crocodiles is nearby. The above-ground buildings are a superhuman accomplishment. The ceilings are made of stone, the walls are also constructed with slabs of extraordinary size, and from the low roof one can see a plain of stone consisting of stones of that great size, Strabo. No wood was used in the construction, according to Plinius and Strabo, but all three writers report that very close to the maze stood one or more pyramids. Both Herodotus and Plinius mention subterranean halls, and Herodotus and Diodorus also describe two additional pyramids emerging from the artificial lake. Only Plinius, however, tells of religious idols and all kinds of horrible creatures. What has happened to this mythical maze so elaborately praised by ancient historians? A majority of Egyptologists believe that the labyrinth was discovered in 1843 by the famous German archaeologist Richard Lepsius, 1810 to 1884. It is thought to be identical to the burial pyramid of Pharaoh Amenemhet III, 1844 to 1797 BC, and its surrounding ruins, which Lepsius located near the modern-day oasis of Fayum. The Merry Archaeologist. Is this assumption correct? What made Lepsius conclude that he had indeed discovered the labyrinth? Did he enter the 1500 rooms? Did he view the sepulchres of the 12 kings? Did Lepsius and his crew from the Royal Prussian Egypt expedition indeed find stone slabs of extraordinary size, or entire stone plains made of equally large slabs, Herodotus? Did the excavators run into all kinds of horrible creatures, Plinius, or winding, convoluted paths, Strabo? They found none of the above. In the 19th century, Richard Lepsius, the son of a district president from Naumburg, was considered the undisputed genius among German archaeologists. He was eccentric, obsessed, enthusiastic, arrogant, skeptical, and stubborn, but also a gallant charmer with great charisma. Lepsius came to Paris in 1833, 1 year after the death of Jean-François Champollion, who had cracked the hieroglyphic code in 1822. Although Lepsius was unable to read the hieroglyphs, he was fascinated by Champollion's work, and he realized intuitively that the decoding was not complete. Lepsius initiated a correspondence with Ippolito Rosellini, one of Champollion's students. 3 years later, they met in Pisa. By that time, Lepsius had learned to read the hieroglyphs. He quickly realized that Champollion understood the hieroglyphics as abbreviated words which conveyed meaning but still remained incomplete. Lepsius added one very significant discovery to Champollion's translations. The hieroglyphs were not only abbreviated words, but also symbols for sounds and syllables. With determination and tenacity, Lepsius copied and translated virtually every hieroglyphic text available in Europe. In 1841, several of Lepsius's friends, Alexander von Humboldt among them, appealed to His Majesty King Friedrich Wilhelm IV of Prussia, in his wisdom and generosity, to fund an expedition to Egypt. The leader of the expedition was to be Richard Lepsius, who by then had published several works about Egypt. The king gave his consent. In August of 1842, the Royal Prussian Egypt Expedition set sail from Hamburg. The team included a painter, a draftsman, a stucco expert, and two architects, plus 30 crates of materials. The Prussians were not pinching pennies. After arriving in Egypt, Lepsius met with the viceroy, who provided him with several letters of authorization and asked him expressly to present as gifts to the Prussian king any archaeological artifacts which Lepsius deemed worthy. No one had begun to catalog any archaeological findings in Egypt. No one had heard of Auguste Mariette, and the Europeans did as they pleased in Egypt. Thus, Lepsius sent 200 crates full of archaeological treasures to Berlin over the years, some of which Egypt would now like to see returned. Richard Lepsius was not an overly sensitive man. On the king's birthday, he had the Prussian flag hoisted on the Great Pyramid at Giza to the tune of the Prussian national anthem. At Christmas 1842, Lepsius ordered the Egyptian co-workers to haul wood to the tops of the three great pyramids so that they could light bonfires to the accompaniment of Silent Night. In a humorous account of the greatest archaeological adventures, Philip Vandenberg describes Richard Lepsius, commissioned by Friedrich Wilhelm to lead this expedition, spreading Christmas cheer, dressed in a dark suit, and holding a candle in his hand. The sarcophagus of King Khufu was adorned with a young palm tree decorated with burning candles. Lepsius could be quite sentimental, and he knew how to sing. All of Cairo was amazed. What did the Royal Prussian Egypt Expedition find? In May 1843, the Royal Prussian Egypt Expedition departed from Giza with a new destination in mind, the Labyrinth. Lepsius was familiar with the reports of Herodotus, Strabo, and others, and he knew exactly where to locate the maze. How? 120 kilometers southwest of Cairo, the desert blooms in a small area of fertile land, the oasis Fayum. The oasis, with its lush vegetation, has been connected to the Nile by means of a canal, the Bir Yusuf, for thousands of years. 25 kilometers northwest of the town of Fayum, one encounters the flat Lake Quarren, which many archaeologists believe to be Lake Moeris. 3,700 years ago, the pharaoh Senwasrit II, 1897 to 1878 BC, had a pyramid built in his honor out here on this heavenly oasis, so starkly surrounded by cracked rocks and sand dunes. According to Diodorus Siculus, the builder of the labyrinth was named Mendes, also called Marhos. Manetho calls the same ruler Lemaire, and Plinius attributes the name of the lake to the person, Moeris. Marhos is also the throne name of Amenemhet III, 1844 to 1797 BC, and this pharaoh moved his summer residence, including his pyramid, to Hawara, 40 kilometers from the shores of the present-day Lake Quarren. Moreover, the ancient capital of the oasis Fayum was called Crocodilianpolis, City of Crocodiles. It once served as the central place of worship for the crocodile god Sobek. It was easy to make the connection. The labyrinth was supposedly located near the city of crocodiles. The builder of the maze was Marhos, and this happened to be the throne name for Amenemhet III. This pharaoh had a pyramid constructed in his honor at the oasis Fayum. Consequently, the labyrinth had to be located near this pyramid, or didn't it? Lepsius was not the first to search for the maze near Fayum. In 1714, the French explorer Paul Lucas had sojourned on the shores of Lake Quarren because he assumed that he would find there the ruins of the two pyramids which protruded from the water in Herodotus's account. However, after inspecting the shoddy, waterlogged boats in which the fishermen planned to take him across the lake, Lucas abandoned his endeavor. In January 1801, Dr. P. D. Martin, an engineer with Napoleon Bonaparte's Egypt forces, rode all the way across the desert to visit the oasis Fayum. The Bedouins were impressed by his willingness to endure such physical hardships, and they answered his questions readily. Still, he did not find the labyrinth. In 1828, the King of France, Charles Philippe X, 1757 to 1836, appointed the studious translator of hieroglyphs, Jean-François Champollion, to lead an exhibition to Egypt. Champollion, a sensitive and highly intelligent man, searched in vain for the labyrinth at the oasis Fayum. Finally, 1 year prior to Lepsius's visit, a French expedition reached the pyramid of Amenemhet III. They found some small walls and broken pillars, but nothing reminiscent of a gigantic maze of buildings. After Julius Caesar won the Battle of Antioch on August 2, 46 BC, he sent three immortal words to Rome: Veni, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. The same thing happened with Richard Lepsius. He came, he saw, and he conquered. Completely sure of himself, he noted shortly after his arrival that they moved camp on May 19, 1843, and pitched their tents in Fayum on May 23rd on the ruins of the labyrinth. He added that the location of the maze had long been correctly identified, and that there was no doubt in his mind he'd rediscovered it the moment he first laid eyes on it. The letters Lepsius sent to Berlin are further evidence of his premature conviction. He stated that his crew had been camped on the south side of the pyramid at Moeris since May 23rd, on the ruins of the labyrinth. He maintained that he was fully entitled to make those assertions and that he'd immediately realized the nature of his discovery. These statements by Richard Lepsius took care of Herodotus's labyrinth, as far as the scholars were concerned. It was conveniently catalogued and labeled, even though a closer look would have revealed that nothing agreed with the descriptions provided by the ancient historians. Lepsius hired men and children from the surrounding villages. They were supervised by overseers and received bread. They were counted every morning and paid every evening. Every man was paid one piaster, every child half of one piaster, sometimes 30 para if they were particularly diligent. The men were required to bring a rake and a woven basket. For the children, a small basket was sufficient. Lepsius had the workers dig trenches in five different locations simultaneously. The men filled the baskets, the children and the old men hauled off the rubble. The procession of the baskets was supervised by the overseers, who also encouraged the busy laborers to sing during their work. After a few short days, Lepsius had cleared an area which revealed the remains of granite and limestone columns shimmering almost like marble. Of course, Herodotus had described real marble stones, exquisitely fitted together. Lepsius was thrilled to find hundreds of chambers, next to and on top of each other, some small, even tiny, others large or even huge, supported by columns with no regular pattern for exits and entrances, so that the descriptions by Herodotus and Strabo are totally justified in this regard. Are they really? Archaeologist versus historian. Where are those walls carved all over with figures, Herodotus? Where are the convoluted winding paths, Strabo? Where is the ceiling made from a single stone? Where are the covered passages roofed with single slabs of surpassing size, Strabo? Lepsius dug up small, even tiny chambers, while Herodotus walked from chambers into colonnades and from colonnades into fresh houses. Neither Herodotus nor any of his successors made any mention of having had to crawl or stoop through the chambers. Regarding the entire structure, Lepsius noted that the layout involves three large building complexes, each 300 feet wide, enclosing a rectangular courtyard 600 feet long and close to 500 feet wide. The fourth side, one of the shorter ones, is bordered by the pyramid behind it, which is 300 feet wide and therefore does not touch the sides of the other buildings. How does this coincide with the 12 roofed courts which Herodotus describes, with the large figures engraved on it, with the chambers exceeding all other human productions? Lepsius personally attests to not having found any inscriptions in the ruins of the large chambers. Herodotus, on the other hand, marvels at the walls covered all over with figures. Lepsius claims that a long wall divides the central square into two halves, while Herodotus speaks of a single wall that surrounds the entire building. 2,000 years ago, Plinius reported that 90 steps descended to the underground galleries. 90 steps? That is quite deep. If we estimate each step at a modern height of 20 centimeters, we would arrive at a depth of about 18 meters below the surface level. Lepsius saw no trace of any such stairs. According to Plinius, there were several houses in underground vaults. Lepsius never entered any subterranean houses. The Royal Prussian Egypt expedition never discovered sepulchres or sarcophaguses of ancient mythological pharaohs. Sic transit gloria mundi. So passes away the glory of the world. The preconceived notion that the pyramid of Amenemhat III was the one under which the labyrinth would be found was wrong from the very start. If Lepsius had kept a clear here and had investigated further, he probably would have realized this. It is true that the name Marhos, which Diodorus refers to, is also the throne name for Amenemhat III. But why did Lepsius refuse to look beyond that? After all, the ancient historians listed many other names besides Marhos in their descriptions of the labyrinth. Here is a list of names. Herodotus. 12 kings, among them by name Psamtik, who ruled Egypt for 54 years. Diodorus Siculus. Mendes or Marhos, as well as Psamtik of Sais and Moeris. Plinius. Petasusias or Titos, as well as Motherudes and Moeres. Manetho. Lemaire. There is no reason to believe that in our research for Marhos, Amenemhat III would be a more valid option than any of the others. In fact, the evidence speaks against his being the builder of the labyrinth, and the evidence is very unequivocal. Contradictions galore. Do you recall our eyewitness, Herodotus? At the corner of the labyrinth stands a pyramid, 40 fathoms high, with large figures engraved on it. And Strabo agrees. At the end is a quadrangular pyramid, which has sides about 4 plethora in width. According to Herodotus, the pyramid is supposed to be 71 meters wide. According to Strabo, the width is 120 meters. The pyramid at Amenemhat III in Hawara, on the other hand, measures 106 meters. Nothing matches. Herodotus and Strabo agree that the pyramid is located at one of the corners of the labyrinth. This is not the case in Hawara. The pyramid at Amenemhat III is not in a corner, but rather on the same axes as the temple ruins. Herodotus, the eyewitness, saw large figures engraved on the walls. You will not find large engraved figures in Hawara, because the pyramid is built from mud bricks. It is impossible to engrave any kind of figure on dried mud bricks, let alone large ones. Just imagine the perversity of it all. All our historical eyewitnesses describe the labyrinth as a wondrous structure with walls that are carved all over with figures, an edifice that excels all other human productions, Herodotus, and cannot be surpassed, Diodorus, made from gigantic slabs of stone of surpassing size, Strabo, with large blocks of syenite, Plinius. Syenite is a limestone resembling marble. And now imagine that the same king Amenemhet III, who dazzled the world with his superb structure, had a burial pyramid built for himself with the cheapest, flimsiest, and most fragile building material possible, mud bricks. That's like a square peg in a round hole. The facts clearly speak for themselves. Each and every pharaoh was proud of his accomplishments. The rulers along the Nile immortalized their feats on tablets and inscriptions so that later generations would know which temples they built or restored. If Amenemhet III had been the builder of the maze, which surpasses the pyramids, according to Herodotus, inscriptions would abound applauding this brilliant achievement and heaping praise on the pharaoh responsible for it. No such inscriptions have been found. In one of the chambers and on some column fragments, Lepsius encountered nameplates with Amenemhet III on them. He concluded quite accurately that this proved the identity of the builder and owner of the pyramid. 45 years after Lepsius, the British archaeologist Sir Flinders Petrie, 1853 to 1942, discovered the undisturbed sarcophaguses of Amenemhet III and his daughter inside the pyramid. The sepulchre consisted of a single block of yellow quartzite lowered into the ground. The burial vault was covered by three heavy quartzite slabs, 1.22 meters thick, enough to bear the weight of the mud bricks above. Finally, canal workers discovered a limestone statue of Amenemhet III about 1.6 meters high near the pyramid. There is not the tiniest trace of any hieroglyph on any of these artifacts that would indicate that Amenemhet III was the builder of the labyrinth. Flinders Petrie found the sepulchre of Amenemhet III completely intact. It is inconceivable that the pharaoh would not have been extolled in his tomb for his accomplishment if he had indeed been the brilliant mind behind the construction of the labyrinth. No pharaoh would have passed up such a grand opportunity to attain immortal glory. It is curious that the same pharaoh, Amenemhet III, also had a pyramid built in Dashur, 20 kilometers south of Cairo. It is popularly known as the Black Pyramid, because it is constructed of dark gray Nile mud bricks. The very top stone of the pyramid, the so-called pyramidion, is 1.4 meters high and made of black granite. It is currently exhibited at the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo. The god Horus spreads his wings over the hieroglyphic inscriptions, which clearly identify Amenemhet III as the builder of the pyramid. Not a word is said, however, about Amenemhet III being the creator of the phenomenal labyrinth. A few years ago, archaeologists from the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo uncovered next to the previously known empty sarcophagus made of rose granite two additional sarcophaguses belonging to two of Amenemhet's wives. Again, there is no indication that their lord and master was the builder of the incomparable labyrinth. I have been reading books about Egypt for many years, books written by intelligent and astute archaeologists. All of them maintain that the labyrinth is located below the pyramid of Amenemhet III in Hawara. Everybody mentions Lepsius and his discovery of the maze. These scholars seem to be climbing a spiral staircase without ever looking back. They simply accept the nonsense that the person in front of them is handing down to them. And we know now that many of the small walls and chambers which Lepsius's singing workers uncovered date back to Greek and Roman times. Amenemhat III was responsible for the construction of the Mud Pyramid and some nearby temples. But these buildings are as unrelated to Herodotus's Labyrinth as Beethoven's Fifth is to music from the Hit Parade. It is evident that the archaeological remains do not coincide with the descriptions provided by ancient historians. But wait until you consider the geographical location. The situation gets positively grotesque. A lake evaporates. Herodotus assures us that the labyrinth and the pyramid are adjacent to Lake Moeris. He describes this lake as astonishing. Its circumference is 60 schones, or 3,600 furlongs, which is equal to the entire length of Egypt along the seacoast. In comparison, Herodotus's lake would have had a circumference of 640 kilometers. Lake Constance, one of the largest lakes in Europe, has a circumference of 259 kilometers. 160 kilometers of shoreline in Germany, 72 kilometers in Switzerland, and 27 kilometers in Austria, with a total area of 538.5 square kilometers. Consequently, Lake Moeris, as described by Herodotus, would have had twice the circumference of Lake Constance. Is it possible that the Egyptians supplied Herodotus with exaggerated figures, or that the figures were translated wrongly from Egyptian into Greek? The figures notwithstanding, it is certain that the labyrinth and the pyramid were located on the shores of the lake, because Strabo also emphasizes the size of Lake Moeris and the fact that the pyramid is set along its shore. Strabo insists that he visited the site personally. Our host, one of the officials, went with us to the lake. Subsequently, in the presence of Strabo and the host, a priest was trying to feed a sacred crocodile, which was dozing on the beach, too lazy to eat the bread being offered. Diodorus Siculus also pays tribute to Lake Moeris. Moeris succeeded to the sovereignty 12 generations after Aegyptus. In Memphis, he built the north Propylaea. Upriver from the city, at a distance of 10 schoenoi, he excavated a lake which is admirable for its usefulness and unbelievable in the scale of the labor involved. For they say its circumference measures 3,300 stades, and its depth, in most places, 50 fathoms. And who, indeed, contemplating the immensity of this endeavor, can help but wonder, and with good reason, how many myriads of men and how many years it took to finish the work? Later in his book, Diodorus supports Herodotus's contention that the water level in the lake was regulated by large locks, which were opened or closed depending on the water level of the Nile. The labyrinth, pyramid, and lake belong together. Geologists tell us, however, that there has never been a lake near the Hawara Pyramid. They base their conclusions on the sedimentation of the soil. Moreover, two additional reasons speak against the existence of such a lake. The pyramid of Amenemhat III is made of thousands of mud bricks. The combination of mud and water, in this case, would be lethal to the pyramid. Its foundation would be weakened. The rooms and chambers dug up by Lepsius's expedition would have been flooded unless they had been strengthened to withstand the lake water. But no waterproof protective walls were found in Hawara. Today, a flat lake, Lake Quarren, is situated about 25 kilometers northwest of the town of Fayum. However, it cannot be identical with Lake Moeris as the ancient historians described it. First of all, it is 40 kilometers from the Hawara Pyramid. Second, it is a natural lake not fed by artificial channels. Third, Lake Quarren is bordered by sizzling desert sands on three sides – and some vegetation in a few tourist hotels on the fourth. And most inconveniently, it is below sea level. Richard Lepsius was well aware of this. He wrote that the lake does indeed rise if the Nile carries a lot of water, and therefore increases its input to Quarren. But he realized that the lake is too low to ever let any of its water flow back. The whole province would have been flooded before the water would flow back to the valley. During Lepsius's visit, the water level of Lake Quarren was about 21 meters below the point where the canal issues into the lake, and Lepsius was convinced that it had never risen significantly above that. He found proof of this in the ancient temple ruins along the shores of the lake. Lepsius concluded that Lake Quarren definitely was not the lake that was adjacent to the labyrinth or the town of Arsinoe, now Medinet Fayoum. In spite of this fact, Lepsius insisted on having identified the location of the labyrinth. Together with three of his colleagues, he had visited the remains of a dam which he interpreted as an artificial mound created for Lake Moeris. Lepsius even studied the ruins of two buildings that he initially believed to be the two pyramids which, according to Herodotus, protruded from the lake. But after a short excavation, Lepsius concluded that it was certain they had not been sitting in a lake. Even people like Lepsius, who are fervently convinced that the labyrinth is located in Hawara, should have been tipped off by the distances specified in the works of Herodotus and others. Diodorus Siculus, for instance, wrote that King Moeris had the artificial lake constructed 10 schoenes above the city of Memphis, which would place it roughly at the same latitude as Dashur, about 70 kilometers northeast of Hawara as the crow flies. Strabo described the lake as a huge body of water with beaches comparable to the ocean. Herodotus specified that none of the land below Lake Moeris was then showing itself above the surface of the water. This is a distance of 7 days' sail from the sea up the river. And finally, Herodotus gives us the following clue. The natives told me that there was a subterranean passage from this lake to the Libyan Syrtis, running westward into the interior by the hills above Memphis. A personal inspection. The taxi driver smiled when he saw me emerge, camera-laden, from my hotel. He knew me well because I had employed his services on several previous days. This way, I avoided the hassle of having to choose from among the hordes of competitive drivers camped out in front of every hotel in Cairo. And I also saved myself the trouble of having to negotiate for a daily rate each time. The taxi driver knew what he could expect, and so did I. Moreover, his vehicle, an older black American car, was in surprisingly good condition, a fact that is crucial in Egypt, where roads rather quickly turn into desert or gravel paths. The driver's name was Kamal, and he had studied Egyptology at the university in Cairo for 4 years. He decided to become a cabbie because he could make more money driving a taxi than by holding a regular job in his field. He knew some English and was adept at keeping the pesky souvenir dealers at a distance. This is particularly refreshing if one considers that most of the guides and dealers know each other and that the driver usually shares in the dealer's profits. We drove along the main highway toward Giza, past caravans of honking, fume-billowing vehicles, past the Great Pyramids, continuing southwest into the desert. The road to Fayoum, about 106 kilometers of straight asphalt, is flanked on both sides by rusty cars and gutted buses and trucks gradually disappearing into the desert sands. "What are you looking for out there?" asked Kamal. "I want to see the pyramid of Amenemhat III at Hawara." "It's not worth it," said a laughing Kamal expertly. "Nothing much to see, just dried bricks." "I know. I want to see it anyway." Kamal laughed again. "You people are all a little strange, if I may say so. No Egyptian would visit the Hawara pyramid on his own free will." A brief thought about Herodotus flashed through my head. Herodotus would have been dependent on camels to get from Giza to Hawara, 2 days' journey. Certainly, he would not have forgotten to mention such a journey in his report. Today, we are fortunate enough to reach the outskirts of the oasis in 2 hours, thanks to our motorized camels. Actually, it is misleading to use the term oasis to describe Fayoum, because the oasis is totally dependent on the Nile for its water, via the Bahr Yusuf Canal. Fayoum, with its 4,000 square kilometers, does not produce any water independently. I will continue to use the term oasis, however, because any water in the middle of the desert is an oasis to us, no matter what its origin. The fertile area of Fayoum, surrounded by desert, is irrigated by 324 canals with a total length of 1,298 kilometers. According to official reports, this system is supplemented by 222 water canals with an additional 964 kilometers. The car radio was breathing a prayer into the air. A muezzin was reciting the prayer, while the crowd hummed. Kamal, while driving, bowed 3 times over his steering wheel. "It's about the water," he explained later. Sheikh El-Azhar, the leader of the Sunnites, had called his followers to ask Allah for water. The summer of 1988 marked the 7th year of a drought in Ethiopia. Without rain, there would be no water in the Nile. Without water from the Nile, there would be no water in the muddy canals, and without that water, there would be no agriculture. "Egypt has the Nasser Dam near Aswan," I said sympathetically. "Doesn't it regulate the flow of the Nile?" Kamal smiled again. He smiled all the time. This time he was smiling about my ignorance. "The water level of the dam has decreased by 25 meters in the last few years. If it doesn't rain in Sudan or Ethiopia within the next couple of months, the turbines will have to be shut off. That would be bad for everything that relies on electricity. If that happens, the little water that's left in the Nile will not be sufficient to feed the thousands of canals on both sides of the river. The fields will dry up. Do you know what that would mean for 53 million Egyptians?" I could imagine it. Throughout its history, the whole country has been dependent on a single source of water. Currently, about 2.6 million hectares of land are irrigated, guzzling up approximately 49.5 billion cubic meters of water annually. An additional 3.5 billion cubic meters are required for drinking water. Whoever Pharaoh X was who commissioned the construction of Lake Moeris, he must have been a wise and provident ruler. After 90 kilometers, we encountered the first vegetation along the road. Merchants waved from their stands, offering rose bouquets, garlands of onions, and live turkeys. After we turned a corner, we saw the first canal. Children were splashing happily in the sluggish brown water. I told Kamal to stop. He was not smiling now. His face had become sullen. "Bilharziosis?" I asked. Kamal nodded. The canals were polluted with Bilharzia parasites, microscopic flatworms named after the German physician Theodor Bilharz, 1825 to 1862, who discovered them. The parasites enter the system through the skin and lodge in the liver, where they multiply, causing diseases of the liver, intestines, and genitals. These conditions used to inevitably be fatal. Today, we have medications to fight bilharziosis. The Egyptian government, in cooperation with the World Health Organization, has been battling this insidious disease for many years. The parasites multiply rapidly in the shallow mud along the canals, where the water is almost stagnant. "Why are the children allowed to swim in the water?" Kamal shook his head. "There are many information campaigns on TV, on the radio, in the schools, even in comic books. But many of the farmers refuse to see the danger. They have faith in Allah. They are God-fearing, honest, and humble, these diligent farmers and their families, who work in the sprawling hot fields all day, year in and year out. They plant cotton, or depending on the season, beans, corn, rice, cucumbers, potatoes, onions, garlic, cauliflower, and watermelon. Harvesting machines are rare. The bent backs of women and children are more economical. Strands of palm trees afford some shade. Every part of the tree is used, from the trunk to the individual fibers. Some women weave baskets in front of the clay huts. Others make clay bowls, lamps, and figures. Children decorate the products in bright colors. Time seems to stand still. Kamal pointed ahead. That's Medina, the capital of the oasis. Nowadays, it's mainly called the Fayum. Supposedly, it used to be called City of Crocodiles. Supposedly? Kamal squirmed and smiled. The thought of the children swimming in the canals and the bilhar psoriasis temporarily wiped from his mind. We know for sure that it was called City of Crocodiles at one time. But if we talk about the City of Crocodiles, everybody thinks of the place that the ancient writers described, the City of Crocodiles on Lake Moeris. And aren't they one and the same? My archaeologically well-versed cab driver shrugged his shoulders and smiled impishly. There were a number of crocodile cities in ancient Egypt, and every larger temple between the Nile Delta and Aswan worshipped the crocodile in some form or another. Here in Fayum, virtually every village had a crocodile shrine. It is difficult to say which city of crocodiles Herodotus was referring to. I thought to myself that this did not resolve any of my questions. Slowly, we zigzagged between the throngs of people, past a truck loaded with camels. The camels are lazier too these days. Kamal stopped the car. "Since you are here, you should take a look at this," he said. In one of the canals crossing the center of town, four huge, dark brown water wheels were churning through the water. They were groaning, cracking, squeaking, and moaning, as if inside of them hidden ghosts were being urged on by invisible whips. The wheels turned continuously. I learned that the oasis Fayum has approximately 200 such water wheels. The wheels direct the water into the different canals and elevate the water level, all without electricity or any other outside source of energy. The only source of energy is the flow of the water. The wheels display superior craftsmanship. They have wide, simple paddles attached to them, which dive into the water with each turn. Powered by the water current, the wheel is forced to rotate. The sides of the wheels are equipped with scoops, which fill themselves with water as they pass through the current and then release the water into the higher canal. The maximum height of this perpetual water lift depends on the circumference of the wheel. It is amazing what ingenious ideas and inventions sprang forth from human imagination thousands of years ago. About 10 kilometers southeast, near the small village of Hawara, the dark gray pyramid of Amenemhet III rises toward the sky. From afar, it reminded me of a cup of pudding turned upside down, with a flattened top and numerous dents. I came without prejudice, and I probably would have jumped for joy if I'd found even a trace of the labyrinth anywhere near the pyramid. In a makeshift shelter, a lonely policeman was startled out of his sleep by our arrival. And next to the shelter, a sign with black borders proclaimed, "Labyrinth, 305 times 244 meters, 3,000 rooms." There is no trace of 3,000 rooms anywhere. I poked around in the sand for a few hours, climbed over some low walls dating back to the times of the Ptolemies and the Romans, shone my powerful flashlight into holes and shafts, and searched eagerly for walls carved all over with figures, Herodotus. The only thing that reminded me even faintly of ancient temples were a handful of blocks of reddish Aswan granite. There were no remains of slabs of surpassing size, Strabo, or large blocks of syenite, Plinius, let alone the skeleton of a structure that exceeded all other human productions, Herodotus. Step by step, I climbed up the southwest corner of the pyramid, searching for something unusual under the grayish-black mud bricks. Perhaps a granite block that, in the times of Herodotus, could have supported the weight of the large figures engraved in the pyramid, Herodotus. I found nothing. The pyramid is partially destroyed. Local builders have used the prefabricated bricks for their houses. The top of the pyramid is missing completely. One could pitch a tent up there. Originally, the pyramid was covered with a layer of limestone, but there is not a trace of it left. Rain has eaten gutters into this mountain of mud bricks. Many of the bricks, originally about 50 centimeters long, have been eroded or worn away over time. The raw material for the bricks was pressed between boards and dried in the sun. As a result, the bricks are porous, blemished with blades of straw, dried grass, and small rocks. Not even an Egyptian Michelangelo could have engraved large figures into these bricks. The mud would have never been able to support the weight of such sculptures. Critics will argue that the figures have long fallen from the walls of the pyramid, that the walls, carved all over with figures, have crumbled over time. But why should that be the case only here, at the Hawara Pyramid and the alleged labyrinth? Broken statues of many pharaohs have been found at other sites and at the wonderful Egyptian temples, which attract millions of tourists each year. The walls, carved all over with figures, have not disappeared into thin air. We know that they still existed in the labyrinth at the time of Herodotus's visit. But never mind. At least the remains of the huge stone slabs of surpassing size should still be laying around. Nothing. There simply is no trace of anything. Nor does the view from the top of the pyramid, 58 meters high, produce better results. All the eye can see are some low walls, sand dunes, and farther off electrical towers, with a canal diagonally dissecting the whole area, and in the distance some cultivated fields. These pitiful piles of rubble are supposed to be the ruins of the exquisitely praised labyrinth? Kamal had discovered a skull amidst the rubble. The policeman placed it on a wall. I stared into the empty eyes of the skull and wondered briefly if the deceased may have met Strabo or Herodotus a long time ago. If the dead could speak, I would ask the skull where to look for the remains of the extraordinary labyrinth. Kamal was laughing out loud. I felt as if the skull were laughing too, in chorus with all the gods of ancient Egypt. The labyrinth a pile of rubble? In 1888, 45 years after Richard Lepsius, the British archaeologist Sir Flinders Petrie came to this site. He concluded that the chambers which Lepsius had unearthed were merely the ruins of the Roman village in which the destroyers of the labyrinth had lived. The maze itself, according to Sir Petrie, had been completely dismantled, the only remaining evidence of its former existence being a hollow in the ground filled with countless small fragments. Petrie asserted that it was extremely difficult to put something back together from such a dearth of fragments, yet he proceeded to attempt just that. I wish he had left it alone. His own version of the labyrinth, a plan with countless chambers and columns, is as incongruent with the descriptions of the ancient historians as the plan submitted by Lepsius. In Petrie's plan, the temples and colonnades run in straight parallel rows. Strabo, however, described winding, convoluted paths and warned that it was impossible to find the exit without a guide. Plinius, too, emphasized the confusing crisscrossing passages. I fail to see why visitors to the kind of labyrinth that Sir Flinders Petrie drew would have had any problem whatsoever finding the exits. They are all aligned with the exactness of parading soldiers. Petrie's plan included several detached temples facing each other at great distances. On the other hand, Herodotus, the eyewitness, spoke of roofed courts that were very close together. Petrie uncovered the remains of walls along the southern and western borders of the site. Herodotus, however, saw a single wall that surrounded the entire building. Petrie's wall cannot be identical to the circular wall described by Herodotus, because if it were, traces of it would have been visible in the northern and eastern sections as well. Petrie's plan of the labyrinth is confusing and full of contradictions. At first, the building is square, then it is rectangular, and finally it is round. Evidently, Petrie, like his predecessor, Lepsius, tried to fit the few available fragments into a preconceived plan. With this method, any archaeological pile of rubble can be transformed into a labyrinth. Petrie's interpretation ultimately failed because he was unable to magically transport the huge Lake Moeris to this site in Hawara, and in spite of fervent excavations, he never found 1,500 subterranean chambers. H. L. Mencken once said that for every problem, there is a solution that is simple, clear, and wrong. Where is the Egyptian labyrinth? Did Herodotus and his successors lie to us? Did this building, which, according to Herodotus, surpassed description, never even exist? Or did the term labyrinth mean something different to the ancient historians than it does to us? Are Herodotus and his colleagues mere plagiarists who stole their sensational stories from other sources? Labyrinthian complications. Today, as in ancient times, a labyrinth denotes a maze, a system of caves with convoluted passageways, or a building with an intricate internal system of stairways, winding corridors, and rooms. Myths about labyrinths originate in the Stone Age. Engraved pictures of labyrinths have been found on rocks and cave walls in northern Africa and southern France, on the islands of Crete and Malta, and in southern India, England, Scotland, and the United States. The maze motif had international appeal even in prehistoric times. The later labyrinthian decorations of Greek geometric vase paintings and Mexican and Peruvian pottery are surprisingly similar as well. We may wonder about the reasons behind this global pattern. What prompted Indians in Arizona to scratch labyrinthian pictures into the rocks if they had no contact with their prehistoric European colleagues? Did the Stone Age people of old continents examine the open skulls of their enemies and use the winding passageways of the human brain as their original model? Were they playing hide-and-seek, or what am I thinking? Were they trying to get a physical grip on the thoughts of the gray cell matter? I suspect that the thought processes of these Stone Age people were much less labyrinthian than ours. Scientists searching for certain motifs can be likened to the shipwrecked Robinson Crusoe, who one day discovers a footprint in the sand. The trail leads into uncertainty. The labyrinth is like a monster with 1,000 tentacles. We can never quite grasp it and always retreat from it because of our fear of the unknown. Greek legend has it that Daedalus, an Athenian architect and inventor, constructed a maze in Gnosis on the island of Crete. Originally, the complex, with its convoluted passages from which no one could escape without help, was intended for the Minotaur, a man-bull hybrid. Both Diodorus Siculus and Gaius Plinius Secundus affirm that the labyrinth on Crete was merely a reduced copy of the original labyrinth in Egypt. Sir Arthur Evans, the great excavator of Crete, found no trace of a labyrinth. This led archaeologists to believe that the term labyrinth originally was not intended to describe a single building, but rather an entire city with a network of streets. Jan Piper, who has studied the labyrinth myth, asserts that there is indeed reason to believe that historically the myth is based not on a single gigantic building with a labyrinthian structure, but rather on a city full of people, which to pastoral tribes must have inevitably appeared labyrinthian, so that they could hardly expect anything but a bull-headed, man-eating monster at its center. Although this argument is alluring because of its simplicity, it will not unlock the gates of the labyrinth. After all, the Stone Age artists on the various continents had no labyrinthian cities teeming with people as models to base their creations on. All of us err, but each of us errs differently. George Christoph Lichtenberg, 1742-1799. Ancient liars? In Egypt, everybody certainly errs differently, because eyewitnesses assure us that they have personally entered the labyrinth. Herodotus emphasizes four times on one page that he is speaking from personal experience. Why should the father of history lie to us in quadruplicate in the space of a single page? After all, he was telling the truth in other places. Why should Strabo reaffirm Herodotus's lies 423 years later, and even add some of his own in the bargain? That would mean the little anecdote about his host, one of the officials, and the priest who was feeding a crocodile on Lake Moeris is pure invention. And what about Gaius Plinius Secundus, who wrote that he was surprised at the stones he saw at the entrance of the maze? Was he surprised on paper only? Why would he want us to believe that he was tired from walking through the impossibly convoluted passages if he never actually walked a single step and therefore could not have become tired? How could he descend 90 steps into galleries that never existed? I believe the old writers. The labyrinth which surpasses the pyramids was a little above Lake Moeris, Herodotus. Can a lake with a circumference of 640 kilometers disappear into thin air? I mentioned earlier that Herodotus's measurements may have been exaggerated, but even a lake of that size can evaporate rather quickly. The Nasser Dam near Aswan has a length of over 500 kilometers. 7 years of drought in Sudan and Ethiopia were sufficient to lower the water level by 25 meters. Even droughts lasting more than 7 years are no reason to expect the end of the world. The Old Testament tells of the 7 years of drought in Egypt, which the people were able to survive because of Joseph's foresight. In Herodotus's account, Lake Moeris was fed by a canal from the Nile. If the river ran dry, the canal was bound to dry up as well. Most likely, the locks to Lake Moeris were closed during any extended drought so that the crucial water supply along the Nile could be maintained. Such water shortages were not uncommon in the land of the pharaohs. Lake Moeris supposedly fed some of its water back to the Nile. But suddenly, things were different. Since Lake Moeris existed during the lifetime of Herodotus, and since Strabo was able to feed a crocodile on its shores 423 years later, the lake must have gradually dried up during the Roman Christian era. The powerful empire of the pharaohs had been subdued. No insightful ruler gave the order to restore Lake Moeris, to dig up the canals and to repair the locks and dams. In geography, Strabo describes several large canals and smaller lakes in Egypt, which were navigable and supplied the sprawling communities with water. What is left of these? A few years of drought combined with a few years of lethargy allowed Lake Moeris to evaporate. Diodorus Siculus hypothetically asked how many people and how many years had been required to create Lake Moeris. Now that the lake was beginning to dry up, the manpower was lacking, as was the command structure that would have motivated and organized a new army of workers. It was the beginning of the end, not just for Lake Moeris and the labyrinth, but for Egypt in general. Temple cities which had been carefully maintained for thousands of years were being abandoned. Giant pyramids and the huge Sphinx of Giza were being devoured by the desert sand. Our present-day excavations are proof of this. But sand not only swallows anything and everything, it also preserves. The labyrinth praised by Herodotus, with its ornately carved walls, 1,500 subterranean chambers, and priceless tombs of 12 mythical pharaohs, is waiting for a modern-day Heinrich Schliemann. Chances that the labyrinth will be found are not too bad, thanks to the numerous clues the ancient historians left for us. If we summarize the information contained in the accounts of Herodotus and his colleagues, we must conclude that the labyrinth is located 7 days' journey up the Nile on the Libyan side, a little above the city of Memphis at the entrance of the canal into Lake Moeris. The lake extended in a north-south direction and was situated in the Arsinoe region. Last but not least, the canal feeding the lake was connected to the Nile and was regulated by locks and dams. Very simple, isn't it? The last chance. It is a simple recipe. Start with a small airplane, maybe a helicopter, and circle above the pinpointed area early in the morning or in the evening. You may have to stir for a while before the dough is ready. Maybe you will have to travel up and down the Nile for a month before you will find a trace. A trace of what? A trace of the canal, my son. What canal? The canal which flowed by the labyrinth, my son. But the canal doesn't exist anymore. Precisely, my son. Aerial photography is a powerful archaeological tool. Canals that have been dry for thousands of years may still be partially visible from the air. Somewhere above Memphis, a canal must have issued westward from the Nile. Its route should still be traceable. If there is no such canal, the only other option is the old Bar Yusuf Canal, on whose banks vegetation continues to thrive. If a canal is discovered from the air, we can follow its course to the end. That would be the location of Lake Moeris, where the labyrinth is waiting to be unearthed. If, however, the Bar Yusuf is the only possibility, we should be able to locate the remains of ancient locks along its original course. They would lead us to the labyrinth, for the ancient historians agreed that the maze was situated at the entrance of the canal. The connection is easy to make, although drawing connections can be confusing. Mark Twain once said that although there is probably a connection between a rose and a hippopotamus, no young man would think of handing his lover a bouquet of hippos. 3. The Nameless World Wonder. Man fears time. Time fears the pyramids. Egyptian proverb. Pickles cause airplane crashes, car accidents, war, and cancer. This amazing headline shocked the academic world in the summer of 1982 when it appeared in the Journal for Irreproducible Results. The statistical evidence was solid. After all, 99.9% of all cancer victims had, at some point in their lives, eaten pickles, as had virtually all soldiers. 99.7% of pilots and car drivers also admitted to consuming pickles occasionally. Naturally, the report was a hoax. Because the Journal for Irreproducible Results, published quarterly in Park Forest, Illinois, specializes in satirizing scientific studies. It demonstrates how statistics, misleading hypotheses, and erroneous interpretations can be used to buttress any claim. Let us experiment with a similarly strange hypothesis connecting the Egyptians' consumption of onions to the construction of the pyramid. At the time the Great Pyramid of Giza was erected, the Egyptians had a passion for onions and radishes. Herodotus tells us that 100,000 workers labored for 20 years to build the gigantic pyramid. If we suppose that every worker ate just 100-gram onion per day, the 100,000 workers combined would have consumed 10,000 kilograms of onions per day. This would come to 100,000 kilograms, or 100 tons, in 10 days, and 300 tons within 1 month. If construction proceeded for 6 months out of the year, the annual consumption would have equaled 1,800 tons of onions. Since trucks and freight trains were non-existent at the time, the bags of onions needed to be hauled by boat, then reloaded onto oxen and donkeys. This means that 200 workers would have been busy exclusively with unloading and distributing the 50-kilogram bags. However, the construction workers most likely did not live on onions alone. We have to assume that each worker devoured about 1 kilogram, raw weight, of fruit, rice, eggs, and vegetables per day. For 100,000 people, this amounts to 100,000 kilograms per day, or 3 million kilograms, 3,000 tons, per month. Hypothetically, we can add to these 3,000 tons the amounts of food consumed elsewhere in Egypt, away from the construction site. This sum can be divided by the acreage of cultivated land in Egypt at the time, and multiplied by the number of holidays honoring Osiris and Horus, on which days twice the regular amounts of food were consumed. This kind of arithmetic eventually leads us to the circumference of the earth in pyramid inches, the distance between the sun and Alpha Centauri in cubic meters, and the diameter of the ozone hole, which was gradually expanding because of the gases generated by the onion-munching Egyptians. Calculations even more absurd than these, with even more hair-raising parallels, have been submitted with regard to the pyramids. One example shall suffice. If we measure the number 666, mentioned in the secret revelations of the Apostle John, in centimeters from the center of the sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid, and adjust the number with the axes of the two air ducts in the king's chamber, the result will point to the month of July 1987. World War III was predicted to erupt during that month. For some mysterious reason, humanity simply ignored the date. Those who seek mathematical correlations in pyramids and other ancient buildings will find them in abundance. Similarly, the length of the desk at which I am working right now stands in some kind of relation to cosmic measurements. Does this imply that all the studious number crunchers and mathematicians who deduce such bizarre data from the Great Pyramid should not be taken seriously? The Great Pyramid features measurements that are fairly obvious. They are there, plain and simple, firmly integrated into this monumental building. Language may require some crutches to be understood, even vaguely, by a handful of experts after so many thousands of years. Numerical values, however, are timeless. 1 plus 1 always equals 2, in any corner of the universe. Where did the meter originate? Every architect requires a unit of measurement on which to base his or her plans. One of our common units of measurement, the meter, corresponds to 1/40 millionth of an Earth meridian. This length was determined by an international meter convention in 1875. Ever since, a meter ruler made of platinum and iridium has been kept as a standard at the International Organization for Standardization in Paris. Precise measurements later yielded some very minute discrepancies in relation to the Earth's circumference. Suddenly, the standard meter was not exactly equivalent to 1/40 millionth of an Earth meridian anymore. A subsequent International Meter Convention in 1927 decided to adopt a new standard for the meter, making it equal to the consistently reproducible wavelength of the light of the red cadmium line in dry air at 15 degrees Celsius. But this new unit, too, was displaced by the progress of a modern world circled by satellites. The newest standard defines the meter as equivalent to the wavelength of a specific spectral line of the gas krypton, number 36, atomic weight 83.7, melting point 157.2 degrees Celsius. Whether it is based on krypton, cadmium, or a meter standard made from a platinum-iridium alloy, the meter unit always refers to 1/40,000,000th of an Earth meridian. An exact knowledge of the Earth's circumference was necessary to arrive at the original meter unit. If 3,000 years from now archaeologists dig up the ruins of the Swiss Parliament while looking for a basic unit of measurement, they will inevitably end up with the meter. They will be able to corroborate their finding through excavations of other buildings from the same period. Maybe some smart scientist will make a sensational discovery. This unit of measurement is equal to 1/40,000,000th of an Earth meridian. Pure coincidence, his colleagues will say, because after all, this would mean that these strange predecessors who built their houses with heavy stones would have known the exact circumference of the Earth thousands of years ago. It is the same story with the sacred yard used in ancient Egypt. It measures 63.5 centimeters, which is equivalent to 1/1,000th of the distance that the Earth rotates in a second at the equator. There was also an Egyptian yard measuring 52.36 centimeters. Nothing more than coincidence? Coincidence? Most likely, because this would imply that the ancient Egyptians knew the rotation speed at the equator and that they calculated in seconds. The coincidences become amazing, however, when they are compounded into monumental complexes rather than being isolated like lonely monoliths. A mathematically gifted acquaintance of mine summarized the controversial data surrounding the Great Pyramid in an excellent brochure. The following is an excerpt. The pyramid is oriented exactly according to the four cardinal points of the compass. The pyramid is located at the center of the landmass of the Earth. The meridian passing through Giza separates the oceans and the continents of the Earth into two equal portions. Furthermore, this meridian is the north-south meridian covering the most land, and also represents the natural starting point for the longitudinal measurements of the entire globe. The angles of the pyramid divide the delta region of the Nile into two equal halves. The pyramid is a perfect geodesic fix and control point. Napoleon scientists were amazed to find that all land within visual distance can be surveyed through triangulation. The three pyramids of Giza form a Pythagorean triangle whose sides have the proportions 3 to 4 to 5. The proportion between height and circumference of the pyramid is equal to the proportion between a circle radius and the circumference of the circle. The four sidewalls are the largest and most conspicuous triangles in the world. With the help of the pyramid, one can calculate the volume of a sphere, as well as the area of a circle. It is a monument to the quadrature of the circle. The pyramid is a giant sundial. From mid-October to the beginning of March, the shadows of the pyramid reflect the seasons and the length of the year. The length of the stone slab surrounding the pyramid is equivalent to the length of the shadow of one day. By observing the shadow on the stone tiles, the Egyptians were able to determine the length of the year down to the 0.2419th part of a day. The normal length of the square base amounts to 365.342 Egyptian yards. The number is identical to the number of days in the tropical sun year. The distance between the Great Pyramid and the center of the Earth is exactly equivalent to the distance between the Great Pyramid and the North Pole, and is therefore the same as the distance between the North Pole and the center of the Earth. The surface area of the four pyramid sides combined is equal to the pyramid height squared. The top of the pyramid represents the North Pole. Its circumference corresponds to the length of the equator, and the two are proportionally correct.